actually, none of which make any reference to the very extensive mathematical physics literature on the subject. There are some reasons for that. In some cases, it's a lack of awareness. But also, two groups have emphasized very different aspects of the adiabatic approximation. Most of the mathematical physics literature views it as an asymptotic expansion for the error when you estimate time evolved state by an instantaneous eigenstate of a Hamiltonian that's varying slowly in time, and they get an asymptotic expansion for the error, you might think of in terms of 1 over the time scale. But usually don't say anything explicitly about the gap dependence. In adiabatic quantum computation, people have been using the fact that's in the assertion in many elementary quantum mechanics books that the first order term for the error depends on 1 over the gap squared, and people think of it as a theorem strictly about the gap. And it's clear from the literature that you need more than that. So today we'll mostly focus on having some people give expositions about what's known about rigorous proofs in the adiabatic theorem and what implications these have for the gap. One particular thing is that you don't need a non-degenerate ground state as is often considered. You can have a projection onto a subspace as long as there's a sufficiently large gap, and this could be useful in examining what adiabatic quantum computation does for things like easy instances of kz, which may not particularly interest complexity theorists, but could give more insight into adiabatic quantum computation. Last night at dinner, somebody said, well, what do random matrices have to do with that? Well, there is one paper that uses random matrices, and I had very much wanted Colin Williams or somebody from his group to come and talk about that. Unfortunately, my early messages to him were filtered out by his spam filter. And when I finally managed to get in touch with him, I discovered that since he works for NASA, which is an agency of the US government, it would take several months to get permission to go to a conference in a foreign country. But basically, there's a long history in mathematical physics of if you know something about there's a lot of literature that Belisar will talk about tomorrow, where if you know something about typical potentials, called random potentials, then you can say something about the spectrum. So maybe in this case, if a complexity theorist can tell us enough about the typical behavior of the final Hamiltonian, people could find a way to say something about the typical behavior of the interpolating Hamiltonian. Since Colin Williams didn't come, and we have some short talks, I decided that I would try to set an example for keeping the short talks within the 10-minute limit by giving the first one trying to summarize his work, which I'm totally unqualified to do, but at least I'm guaranteed that Bill Ferris will see to it that I stay to the 10-minute time limit. Most of the talks are expository, and we've saved a lot of time for discussion, and you'll see the facilities here are very nice. There are lots of nooks and places where you can gather and with blackboards discuss things. We have the distro, and sometimes we'll also have access. This is the Bob room to the Alice room directly below that. We'll be introduced to that. We have coffee. We can, if something comes up in the discussions, or if a speaker doesn't, if people want more details about a particular speaker's topic or something, we can schedule additional talks. But the following principle, which will hold the way that Arthur Eckert runs his workshops at FNAC. If you come and tell me you want to give a talk on something, the answer will certainly be no. In order to schedule an additional talk, it takes a group of 3 to 6 people to tell me they want to listen to something, or that they would just like to, if possible, say, schedule the Alice room to discuss a certain topic in more detail. So the short talks will be a limit of 10 minutes, and I suggest that you have at most 2 or 3 transparencies, and just try to give people enough of an idea of what the topic is, so they can ask you questions in the discussion, okay, rather than trying to summarize anything. Does anyone have any questions about anything? Yes?
I'm going to show to what extent I'm a physicist and not a computer scientist, maybe, but what is KSAT?
Well, the Andrew Childs School, are you going to explain that in your talk?
Yeah, I think so.
Explain, rather than having me, but it's one of the NP complete problems that computer scientists are very interested in, and that was, you know, one of the proposals, the early proposals for adiabatic quantum computation, constructed final Hamiltonians whose Brown state would solve this problem. Any other questions? So, the first speaker is scheduled to start at 9:30. My watch was 1 to 2 minutes away, but by somebody else's watch is longer, but maybe I'll give a long-winded introduction and then George could. So the first speaker is George Hagedorn, who has done a lot of work on the adiabatic approximation. In addition, he has studied the dynamics of energy level crossings and avoided crossings in every conceivable symmetry situation that you can think of, and several that you cannot. But I believe that physical chemists have actually found real molecular situations in which all of these various symmetry situations that George has looked at actually do occur.
There are one or two exceptions to that. Well, essentially all of the interesting ones that have examples.
How do you define interesting?
Oh, there's really some non-trivial structure, and they don't just behave like one of the other ones.
Oh, I see. I thought the interesting ones were the ones that actually came up in physics.
No, I mean, there are some really complicated ones, and the methane plus ion has a codimension 5 cross. That's the most complicated of all the generic crossings.
Okay. So he's looked at all possible crossings and also avoided crossings, which also transmit the information. He's one of a very small number of people whose research was at some point jointly funded by at NSF by one of the mathematics groups and theoretical atomic and molecular physics. So, and Ed Parry is here, so we can now let George begin.
So that was your reason for delaying?
No, it was just good timing. And they have a sophisticated Canadian pointer here.
Well, let's see, I'm supposed to turn this thing on. So hopefully I'm not too loud. If it's too loud, let me know if I can turn it down. Okay, let's see here. So again, I'm George Hagedorn. I'm at Virginia Tech. And let's see, I gave as vague a title as I could at the time because I was much too busy to decide exactly what I was going to talk about. So this was meant to be a vague title where I could wing it later on and decide just what to talk about. Also, I'm not part of this quantum computing business. I'm largely ignorant. I didn't know, I asked Beth earlier what KSAT meant, because I had no idea. And my main interests have been with sort of chemical physics problems, where the adiabatic approximation plays a big role. The situation there is that nuclei in typical chemical situations are moving much more slowly than the electrons. So there are two time scales, one for the nuclei, one for the electrons, and that's where the adiabatic approximation comes in. So the situation there is somewhat different, though, because the electron Hamiltonian depends on all the nuclear coordinates, so you have lots of degrees of freedom to worry about, because there are typically, if you have n nuclei, there are 3n degrees of freedom that the electron Hamiltonian depends on. Whereas for the usual adiabatic business, there's just one degree of freedom, the T, that it depends on. So Beth had asked me to talk about adiabatic approximations and to give a real-life proof in at least some situations of the adiabatic theorem. And so I've chosen to do this in the simplest possible case. So put this here. I'm going to look just at the absolutely simplest situation and try to write out essentially a complete proof that the adiabatic theorem really is a theorem. And you know, there are various things which have looked like counterexamples out in the literature lately, and hopefully the proof will convince you. And so that's one of my roles here. Also, it should probably set up some things for later in the day when people will be giving other talks, which are probably more relevant to exactly what's of interest in the quantum computing business. So I want to start off, let's see, I could use the hockey stick or a finger. Looking, the original way this game shows up, you want to solve the time-dependent Schrödinger equation in a situation where the Hamiltonian depends slowly. And it's worth making sure you make it clear what slowly means. That's the source of these supposed counterexamples that are out there, because they're not careful about what slowly means. So I have it explicitly in there. This epsilon is supposed to be a small parameter, and I'm going to look at estimates as epsilon goes to zero. So in terms of this time s, I'm going to go over a time on the order of 1 over epsilon, and look at solutions to this equation. It's convenient to rescale the time to what I call t here, so that t stays in a fixed interval for me, and the equation is I epsilon d psi dt is h of t psi. And you can, this is already a non-trivial business if h of t is a 2x2 matrix. In the situations I'm usually interested in, it's infinite dimensional, but you can do all the various possibilities. And I'll assume h of t is self-adjoint, depends smoothly on t, and I'm going to look at the non-degenerate case because I wanted to concentrate on the simplest situation. You can handle finite degeneracies, you can handle situations where you have a band of continuous spectrum that's separated from other spectrum. There are all sorts of possibilities. The other thing I want to assume here is that there's a non-trivial gap, so that some eigenvalue that I'm going to call E of t is separated from the rest of the spectrum by some non-zero amount which stays bounded below. There are other circumstances where you can look at level crossings and things like that and still prove various results. But again, I'm trying to concentrate on the simplest possible situation here. So I'll look at the solutions which are associated with this eigenvalue E of t and give a proof of the adiabatic theorem here. And my apologies to all the experts in the audience who are going to be bored. As I know, there are several here who could easily give you a proof off the tops of their heads. So the first issue, which again showed up in some of these papers which claim to have counterexamples, involves the question about Berry phases. If you're just doing the adiabatic approximation, again, there's only one parameter that the Hamiltonian depends on, namely the time. And in that case, you don't have to worry about Berry phase issues to the extent that you do in the sort of molecular situation where you have lots of parameters for the Hamiltonian. So I want to choose a normalized eigenvector corresponding to this eigenvalue E of t, and I want to choose the phase of it in a particular way so that the inner product of the eigenvector with its time derivative is zero. This the word connection is up there because the set of eigenvectors forms a vector bundle, in this case over an interval, and we're doing parallel transport in the vector bundle as we move around in the base space. So and the thing which allows you to do that is the connection, which I'm obeying here. So the first fact is that I can make this choice of eigenvectors so that I can satisfy this phase condition. And in that sense, there's no issue about Berry phases. I can choose this guy as a function of time, and then I'm done with it. I don't have to worry about it anymore. There are some little warnings, though. You might have the Hamiltonian take exactly the same value at two different times, but get different eigenvectors, different phases on the eigenvectors. I'll write down just a second on the board here, probably a very simple example where that sort of thing can happen. But in the, in fact, let me do that now. In the molecular case, the situation is much more serious. Let me, for the moment, just write down Hamiltonian. Cosine t, sine t, sine t, minus cosine t. This is a nice smooth 2x2 Hamiltonian. The eigenvalues are plus or minus 1. And if I choose, well, one of the eigenvectors, I can choose this way. You can just work out, there's some trigonometry, trig identities to be done to check that this is an eigenvector with eigenvalue 1. And if you go from time 0 to time 2 pi, you get the same Hamiltonian, but this guy picks up a minus sign because you've only gone through half the angle in the eigenvector. So in that sense, that's what I mean by this comment that's on the slide up here, that you might have a different choice of eigenvector at the two different times, even though you've got the same Hamiltonian. For the molecular case, by the way, you might have the sort of interesting thing here. If I have two parameters on which my Hamiltonian depends, and I try to obey the analogous condition, where it's the gradient in the xy variables, I can't satisfy that everywhere in a region which goes around the origin. So there's a much more serious problem here that you can't make a global choice of eigenvectors, even if you stay away from the crossing when you have more than one parameter. So there's a much more serious situation. Yep.
You wanted to say that your choice is normalized by this condition.
Yes, my choice is normalized. Otherwise you can do it, right. But let's see, to make that even worse, if you have three parameters, you cannot make a smooth choice of the eigenvector for this corresponding to the square. One of the eigenvalues is the square of x squared plus y squared plus z squared. In fact, the two eigenvalues are these. And you cannot make a smooth choice of the eigenvectors on the entire unit sphere. For these, there's a topological obstruction. So these very phase issues are a mess if you have more than 1 degree of freedom. But for 1 degree of freedom, everything becomes much easier. And there's no issue. And I'll give you a proof here. And the proof is just to use standard perturbation theory, the sort of thing you can find in Kappa's book, to choose an eigenvector that depends smoothly on t. And I've called that phi 1 here. And you can choose it to be normalized. Then if you just take the derivative of the square of the length of the vector, you get this quantity. And it's something plus its conjugate. So you see that it has to be purely imaginary. And so if I multiply by I get something real. And I can define theta just to be the integral of that. And then you just sit down and do the computation. E to the I theta of t phi 1 of t satisfies the condition. So this is just completely straightforward. You just do this little calculation and you're done. Then the first theorem is the, I think the thing Beth really wanted me to prove, is the one at the top here. That the Schrödinger equation has a solution of the form this phase factor that depends on time, times this eigenvector chosen with the phase I chose a moment ago, plus something of order epsilon in norm. And that's true uniformly for the t in a fixed interval. Okay, and you can improve this. And as long as I'm proving the first theorem, it's easy for me to go to the second theorem by the technique I'm going to use. Which says that there's a solution to the Schrödinger equation which has this phase times something which is an asymptotic expansion in powers of epsilon. And again, I'm assuming that you have a non-trivial gap and all of that. All of the assumptions that I had earlier. And there are two standard techniques that get used. And I changed the date for Kato on my transparency, but not on here. It's 1950 that he published this, not 1949. I've made the transparency from memory and then checked later. He probably wrote the paper in 1949.
If it were a quant pH, then it would have been had a 49.
Yeah, I agree.
George, I'm wondering if the error term is actually not a order epsilon or n, not a plus one.
Well, you can arrange things so that it's, it depends on what you mean by plus of n, I think. But you know, we can argue about whether it's n or n plus one. Right. That won't matter, but I can always go to the next order and then drop the n plus first term. So anyway, the point is that there's an asymptotic expansion. Right? So there are these two techniques that are used for proving these things. There's this technique, which is originally due to Kato, that I think you're going to hear about this afternoon in some other talks, which involves an integration by parts technique and usually some iteration if you go to high order of, you end up doing a recurrent sort of operation. The technique which I will use really parallels what you'll find in the really old paper of Born and Falk in 1928, which is to do just sort of a straight asymptotic expansion. The first technique is what tends to show up more in the mathematical physics literature, but the other technique works perfectly well. There's an advantage in some of the things which use this first technique that you get a unitary propagator for everything. The propagator I'll construct as the adiabatic propagator will only be approximately unitary. So there are some advantages to using the other technique. And let's see, I have a remark at the bottom here. Without working too terribly hard, you can improve this second theorem. And the idea is to choose the capital N to depend on epsilon. So be more careful about how you've constructed the error estimate here. And as you make epsilon smaller, make N larger. And do so in the optimal way so that you minimize the error. This is the technique of optimal truncation. And if you use that technique, you can come up with approximations which are exponentially accurate in 1 over epsilon. So, and it's not that hard. The idea is essentially to show that the error term looks like an exponential in n times an n factorial. And then you're in business. So, I won't go through that, but there are some fairly elementary ways of getting those finer estimates. Oops, let me put up the paper version. So it'll show it a little better, I think. So in order to get a rigorous proof here quite easily, I want to start off with what my friend Alain Joie calls the magic lemma, which allows you just to do some formal calculations and then prove some easy estimates and then get a rigorous theorem by doing sort of formal calculations. So the idea is that you're supposed to come up with some candidate psi sub epsilon for an approximate solution to the Schrodinger equation, somehow. It doesn't matter how you did that, but you've got some candidate you think is a good approximation. Just substitute it into the Schrodinger equation and compute the difference from the two sides. So this quantity I call zeta sub epsilon of t is just the residual that's left over after you substitute it into the Schrodinger equation. And suppose you have some kind of estimate. It's less than this quantity, which I call mu of epsilon and t. Then this little lemma says that your candidate agrees with an exact solution of the Schrodinger equation up to an error estimate, which loses 1 power of epsilon and integrates this mu with respect to time. So that's the thing which I will use to get a rigorous proof out of what will be formal computations. So I'll construct this psi sort of formally. You can then just substitute in the Schrodinger equation. If everything is nice and smooth, you can easily get an estimate for this, a candidate for this mu, and then just check that everything's fine and get the error estimate that you want. Yes?
So to enable people like me to think rather than write, are we going to be able to get your copy of your paper or your...
Oh, I can give you something afterwards. That would be fine.
I should mention also that all of the talks are being taped and will be on the web, so you can listen again. We can make a transparency.
Sure. Yeah. And also, I could give you some other references where this is explicitly done. Okay, and let's see, I have here, this is an easy lemma to prove. It's again quite elementary. I'm trying to do everything in the most elementary way possible, just to make things as clear as I can. So the error you want to estimate is the norm of the difference between your candidate, this psi sub epsilon, and the exact solution where you've applied the true propagator to your state at time zero. So this norm I've written out up here, I guess I can use a hockey stick, is this is the error written out exactly. Then this propagator for the Schrodinger equation is unitary, so I apply its inverse inside here, and that doesn't change the norm. Then I use the fundamental theorem of calculus. But see, I've given this talk in Europe. They don't call it that in Europe usually. But you write the function as the integral of its derivative. And that's what we call the fundamental theorem of calculus, at least in the US. And then you simply compute this derivative explicitly. And that's where you start seeing the Schrodinger equation show up. And you'll notice this looks essentially like the zeta that I have up above, to this factor of 1 over epsilon and an I, which is trivial. And then all I'm going to do is put the norm inside the integral. This piece will disappear because it's unitary. I'm going to put the norms inside. It preserves norms, so it doesn't do anything. And then I use my error estimate that this zeta, which is showing up in here, is bounded by mu, and then that proves the theorem, or the one. Incidentally, everything here is sharp, except for my putting the norm inside the integral. So if you want to improve upon this, this is the only place where I'm being careless, is when I put the norms inside the integral. There might be some oscillations which are causing this to be much smaller than what you're actually seeing. So, but that everything else along the way is sharp in all circumstances. Okay, so. The 1 over epsilon comes because the way I defined the zeta has I epsilon here and doesn't have that epsilon down there.
Oh, I see.
So it's just the way I defined the zeta. That's because the usual way of writing the Schrodinger equation has the epsilon out front. You should just divide the whole equation by epsilon.
So epsilon is big.
No, epsilon is small.
Okay, so the bound is.
So the bound, so the mu is what's really going to be small.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to lose one power of epsilon along the way.
Epsilon is 1 over the top.
Yeah, 1 over the top. So the mu is going to be much smaller than the epsilon.
Oh, okay.
So that's how I get a good epsilon.
That's why mu is small.
Right. Yeah. So, this always seems a little bit peculiar because you have to compute to a one order higher than you might think you have to in order to get the rigorous result, because you're going to lose one power because of this. Okay. So that's that. And now I can just go on to how I'm going to prove the theorem. But again, I'm going to use this asymptotic expansion approach instead of the integration by parts approach in this whole game. So what I do is just behave like a physicist. I put in what I think is the right ansatz for the solution I'm looking to, and then I'm just going to check afterwards that it's all right. So I just make an assumption that this candidate, what I call psi sub epsilon on the previous slide, is going to be given by the phase factor I'm expecting times an expansion. And then I'm just going to compute. That's going to give me the candidate. Then I'll use the lemma from the previous slide to get a rigorous theorem out of all this. Okay, so I just substitute this ansatz into the Schrodinger equation and compute the two sides. And then I just equate the powers as starting from the lowest order and work up and see what happens. So here I've written the Schrodinger equation with this phase, with this expansion put in, and I've divided out the exponential of this phase factor on both sides. So the Schrodinger equation, after I've substituted this in, gives me this form. And then I first start off looking at the epsilon to the zero terms. There's nothing on the left, formally, which has epsilon to the zero, because there's this epsilon out here. And so the equation I get is just h minus e, 1 to psi 0 is 0. So it's the eigenvalue equation. And so this psi zero has to be some scalar times the eigenvector. I don't know what this f zero is at this point, but it's just some scalar function times the eigenvector that I've chosen, because I assumed that everything was non-degenerate for this eigenvalue e. Okay, so that's all you learn at order zero. When you go to order one, having used what you learned here, you pick up a derivative of the psi zero, which I've written out explicitly over here. And then on the right-hand side, you just pick up the h minus e times the psi 1. And so it's exactly this equation I wrote down here. And so now I have to worry about how I'm going to solve that. And the technique for solving it is to look at two separate components here. So I take that equation and break it into two pieces. In the Hilbert space of states, I look at things which are in the direction of the eigenvector phi of t, and I look at everything orthogonal phi of t. Okay, and you have to have equality in both of those subspaces, since you're supposed to have equality. And for the piece which is in the direction of phi of t, you just get that the time derivative of f0 is 0. So let's see, let me put this back up for a second. Here I can show both of these at the same time. There we go. So this guy's in the phi direction, obviously. This is orthogonal by our choice of phase. The phi and the phi dot are orthogonal to one another. So this is orthogonal. And this operator kills off everything in the direction of phi. So the only piece in the direction of phi is this first one, and that's where I get this equation. Everything else is in the orthogonal direction, and that's where I get this other equation. So I break things into the two pieces and solve them separately. So, and now I'll get confused with what's where. All right, so the first equation is trivial to solve. The time derivative is 0, so f0 is a constant, and I'll take it to be 1. The second equation is a little more subtle. The operator on the left-hand side here is invertible on the orthogonal complement of the span of phi. And so just invert it on that orthogonal complement and apply it, and you'll construct this thing that I'm calling psi 1 perp here. And there could also be a piece of psi 1 in the phi direction, and you learn nothing about that at this point. Because if there is a piece in that direction, the h minus e kills it, so you wouldn't learn anything about it. So you're forced to have psi 1 be something times the eigenvector plus this perpendicular piece, which you just get by applying the reduced resolvent to the two sides. Okay, and so to prove the first theorem, I just arbitrarily choose this f1 to be 0. I won't care what it is, and I'll just arbitrarily make it 0. And then I'll take psi 0 plus epsilon psi 1 perp and use that as my candidate, you know, times this phase, for the lemma that I had a couple slides back. And when you substitute this into the Schrodinger equation, the choices you have made kill off the epsilon to the 0 and the order epsilon terms, leaving you with epsilon squared terms. You got a question?
Can you sort of justify f1 being chosen to be 0 by saying that you're going to put all the phi part in the 0 third order terms?
The proof will work regardless of what you put in here at this point. Mm-hmm. So it's just not going to matter. It's going to affect higher order corrections at this point. That's the real reason. Mm-hmm. So, and when you can just check that this works by just choosing it to be 0. If you're going to go to higher order, you have to get it right. So, and that's what I'll do. I'll continue this to show how you do the higher order here in a moment. But you have to choose all these other things correctly. And then when you substitute this into the Schrodinger equation, the order epsilon to the 0 and epsilon to the 1 terms will all cancel. And then the everything that's left over is epsilon squared or higher. Then the lemma tells you you lose one power, so you end up with an estimate which is order epsilon. And this is what you get. Let's see. And then if you want to, you can drop this term after you've proved the theorem. The psi 1 perpendicular term has to be there for this proof. But after you've done the proof, this piece you can just throw in with the error, and you get just the phase times the eigenvector plus an order epsilon piece. The intuitive reason for why you have to put this guy on here is that the solution is doing rapid oscillations near a something which is nice and smooth. The rapid oscillations are small in amplitude, but they're rapid. And the technique we've been using here is to bound things involving the derivative. And you have to get the rapid oscillations right, or close enough to right, in order to get a rigorous proof if you're going to do bounds that involve the derivative. Because the rapid oscillations cause the derivative to be much larger. And so that's why this proof requires you to put this guy in, but then after you're done, you can throw it away. Okay, so that gives you a proof of the first of these theorems. And now let me continue on and indicate how you do the higher order terms as well.
You assumed always regularity of them.
Yes, I'm always assuming regularity. Yeah, I didn't want to get involved in this. I think my recollection is you need the Hamiltonian to be C2 in order to get through what I've done so far. Yeah, for the first one. It might be that C3, I haven't worried about that recently. And if you're in an infinite dimensional case, instead of worrying about the Hamiltonian smoothness, which may not make any obvious sense, it's the resolvent which needs to have the smoothness.
But if you look at your proof,
uh-huh.
You know, you prove rigorously that if epsilon goes to 0, you stay in the ground state.
Right.
That's basically what you've shown.
Yeah.
But do you have a sense from your proof of how big epsilon, how small epsilon has to be in terms of the gap? Does that come out?
That will come out also. And I'll make some comments about that later on. That's I've gradually learned by talking to Beth is the thing which really interests people here. And let's see, I think later on here somewhere I have explicitly written out what the errors look like, what the leading term error looks like. So that gives some idea of how things should depend on the gap. Let's see, let me continue then to go to higher order. You just continue to play the same kind of game. So, and it's sort of an induction that I'll describe here. Suppose you've gone through all the previous steps you've done, and you've determined the Fj's through order n minus 2, and the psi j perpendiculars through order n minus 1. So I've done that so far when n is 1, right? Explicitly before. And then you look at the n plus first, or the nth order terms here, and that gives you just these pieces. And you substitute in what you know from the earlier order and compute the time derivative of the previous piece. And that has to equal h minus e times the next piece. And once again, you split this into two conditions by projecting into the phi direction and projecting into the orthogonal direction. In the phi direction, this is the condition you get. And in the perpendicular direction, you just get this thing, which is a little more complicated. And in order to solve this equation, all you have to do is an integral. Right, because you just divide by I, move this to the other side, and integrate. And in order to solve this orthogonal piece, you just have to get rid of this operator, and it's invertible on the orthogonal complement of phi, so you just apply that reduced resolvent to get rid of this piece, and this gives you the psi n perpendicular. And again, if your Hamiltonian is regular enough, everything in sight can be shown to be regular, and there's no problem doing these computations. And then you take psi 0 plus epsilon psi 1 plus epsilon squared psi 2 and so on through psi n plus the psi n plus 1 perp term. And use that as the candidate for the approximate solution in the lemma, and the bound comes out right away. So that's a way of proving that you can do these asymptotic expansions to all orders. And incidentally, the exponential business is just to do the same thing, but keep track of the constants that are multiplying the epsilon to the n. And you have to chase through the iterative procedure for computing the psi n's and get the appropriate bounds there, the one conducive. So I guess I put a slide up here which says essentially the same thing. And this hopefully will start to answer your question a little bit. So the theorem two, as I said, follows from just using this expression I have at the top as your candidate in the lemma, and then you get the bound. And if you look at what happens when at the error bound I get from just doing the leading order term, the leading order piece, the bound you get, is exactly this. So you get epsilon, the norm of the time derivative of phi divided by the gap. So that's explicitly what the next term looks like. And you can't do better than that, because that term is really there. That's the piece in the orthogonal direction to the eigenvector.
Is it conceivable that, I mean, could there be additional gap dependence in phi dot?
Well, not the way I've done it, right? Because, well, it depends on what you mean. If you're changing the Hamiltonian, then you can change the eigenvalues, you can change the eigenvectors. So what are you changing when you change the Hamiltonian, right?
You were talking about first order
corrections. First order corrections, right.
So if you go beyond that artificial term, which
Right, yeah, which we'll hear about this afternoon from Sabina.
No, I think phi dot is proportional to one over gap.
Well, it depends on how you define your Hamiltonian. I can take a fixed projector, fixed function of time, and then multiply it by whatever function I like. So I can change the eigenvalues independent of changing the eigenvectors. It depends on the problem you're trying to look at.
Well, I thought you fixed the phase of phi dot.
Yes, I fixed the phase of phi dot, but I mean, I could, for example, I could multiply.
Phi dot is not normalized.
Phi dot, phi is normalized. Phi dot isn't.
No, I understand that. But phi is normalized.
Phi is normalized.
And
has a fixed phase.
And so phi dot is
really. So the phi dot in my game is really fixed, and the gap. You know, I could always multiply the Hamiltonian by two, and it keeps the same phi, but it doubles the gap. So these things are.
Look, this is the expression.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Well, you have the gap is what's in the denominator.
And in the numerator, you have the derivative of the expression.
Okay.
My question, this phi is can be computed, phi dot can be computed using the step representation, and therefore, if you know that h dot is bound, right? So h dot now is held to be also size 1. Then you know that phi dot will also size 1. It's not
one of them. We're one of them down.
Right.
Yeah, for example.
What I'm saying is that h is now scales, which are not really dependent on epsilon.
Right. I can, for example, I can take, you take whatever you, you know, I can take E1 of t. Times a projection onto any fixed function, any fixed normalized eigenvector here. I can take that to be my Hamiltonian and make it just zero on the orthogonal complement. And then I can change the gap just by changing this without ever changing that. So the phi doesn't change even though I can change the gap. So there's more than just the gap involved.
It depends on the energy scale.
It depends on the energy scale, right. Well, the gap, yeah. The gap, how you measure the gap depends on the energy scale you use to measure the gap, right. So, right. But there's something more than just the gap going on. That's, the emails that you and I exchanged, you kept focusing on the gap, and I kept puzzling about this, because there's another variation here, which is important, and which is how rapidly the phi depends on t. So there are a couple of issues here And well, it comes up very explicitly here when you do these computations. You see the phi dot showing up explicitly, and you also see the role of the gap in this leading order term. Okay, so.
The point is that it's not only the leading order term which is relevant.
Right. There are other terms which come on later. And also, I want to make some comments about some ideas where you might actually be able to really improve these errors. For example, if you're in a situation where phi dot is zero somewhere, this guy goes away, and then everything is controlled by higher order terms. So I want to comment about that as we go on here a little bit. And that's one of the things. There's been a lot of activity in the past roughly 20 years. Even though this is sort of an ancient theorem, there are various things. A lot of the higher order work was first pushed by Georgi Nenshu. There was also work Rudy Zeiler was involved with, and Yossi Avron and Jaffe. There have been all sorts of improvements and generalizations. And I just wanted to mention a few of them. See, Alexander Elgart's up here also. I think he had the first generalization with no gap. So you can even get rid of the gap and still get some estimates. You don't know sort of what order things are. But there are all sorts of improvements that I want to mention, and some of which go way back to the 1930s in some sense. So I've listed on the next two slides here various improvements. The first one I've been involved in a little bit, I think it was originally due to Nenshu, and then Joie and Pfister really pushed it later on. If you have a Hamiltonian which is analytic in a strip around the real axis, you can improve these estimates to get exponential accuracy by this optimal truncation game. I've mentioned it before. So you can make the estimates exponentially small in 1 over epsilon. The other comment which I think might be useful here is suppose I have a Hamiltonian which is constant until time minus capital T, and then very smoothly, and then it's constant again after time capital T. So it only varies on a compact set of times. And again, I want to assume that it's nice and regular and smooth, and there are no issues about that going. Then if you actually do this expansion, suppose I start time minus infinity in the eigenstate, there are no corrections. The Hamiltonian is not depending on time. If you start in an eigenstate, you stay in an eigenstate. And if you do these computations, you get zero to all orders. And then as you go through the time region where something's happening, you pick up all of these terms. And then after you've gone through, the expansion again becomes trivial for times bigger than capital T. So you don't pick up orthogonal terms after time capital T. The only things that are left over are the terms you got by doing the integrations. So the piece which is orthogonal to the eigenvector is order epsilon to the n for all n, assuming you have a C infinity Hamiltonian. So the error estimates become drastically better in this situation if you're able to have things that start off being constant very smoothly and then become constant again. The sort of asymptotic expansion terms all go away. There still is an error, but it's smaller than you're going to be able to pick up from the asymptotic expansion. And this might be of use in the quantum computing business. I don't know. The same kind of phenomenon occurs in, yeah?
I don't really understand that, because in what you've done so far, you're considering a time interval, time interval anyway. So what does it matter whether you can do or don't consider what happens outside that time?
Oh, so suppose I were to extend the time interval a little bit beyond, then I can still give the proof I gave before. And before I get to the time when it starts varying, when I do the expansion, I find zero for all of the corrections. And then if I go through and then compute for this little interval afterwards, the pieces which are orthogonal are all zero again. So I'm still in the direction of the eigenvector to all orders that I compute. You have to actually sit down and do the computation to see that.
So you're losing boundary terms or something?
You're losing sort of boundary terms. In fact, if you use the integration by parts technique, it's exactly the boundary terms from the integration by parts that you're losing. Mm-hmm. you're picking up all the integral in between, but you're losing the boundary terms.
When the Hamiltonian is constant and then varies and then constant, I mean, is it saying it's smooth a little bit fishy?
Well, you can always arrange for that to happen.
If it's smooth, that only first derivative is
smooth? Well, you can make it C infinity if you're in finite dimensions. You can make it C infinity without any problem. By using a partition of unity, you can sort of argue that you can do that. You can't do analyticity that way, of course. Right. Yeah. So there's sort of a...
You can do Jevre class.
Yeah, you can do Jevre class.
And then you have right. Even such a... Then you have the next one and the next one.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so in fact, some of us have played... Yeah. You get a power on the epsilon in the exponent, right, if you play the Jevre classes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see, another, you brought up the right issues here. If you want everything to be analytic, then you can't do this. You can't make the variation just be on a compact set. But if you have a situation where the Hamiltonian is approaching a constant rapidly enough in a uniformly in a strip as the real part of T becomes large in absolute value, then you can play the same game and get exponential exponents for the scattering transitions. Of course, that takes an infinite amount of time, which might not be a good thing if you're trying to do quantum computation. There are lots of estimates. Alain Joie really got his career going by proving estimates of this sort and doing the scattering theory. In addition, people have looked at what error really comes up in doing scattering theory by a sort of complex WKB technique, where you make T complex and construct appropriate approximate solutions, and then by moving up and changing the contour along which you're solving the differential equation, you can sometimes explicitly get the leading behavior of the non-adiabatic transition between time minus infinity and time infinity in the analytic case. And that gives if you go through all of this, it gives a rigorous justification to Landau's version of what's called the Landau-Zener formula. And I've written out how the transition amplitude goes if you have a very small gap. Asymptotically for small gaps, this is the transition amplitude, the non-adiabatic transition amplitude in the limit of small gaps. There have been further developments in this in the last, well, we're getting down to 5 or 10 years, I guess. Michael Berry originally had the idea of what he calls the super adiabatic approximation. I sort of object to that term. There's too much super stuff in physics. But his idea was that you should do this optimal truncation game that I've been doing here, and then use the results of that as your sort of starting point for doing another perturbation theory. So construct the optimal states, and then use them as the basis in which you write your Hamiltonian, and then go from there. And do another perturbation scheme on top of that. And he formally claimed that you should get the exponentially small factor times something which looks like an error function if a single avoided crossing is governing the non-adiabatic transition. Alain Joie and I worked very hard at this, and we came up with essentially one H of T, it's a 2x2 matrix on which we could prove this. We worked for about 3 years. There's just one line in Berry's paper that we couldn't justify for a very long time. And shortly after that, Teufel and Bates essentially redid what we did by a slightly different technique, and then I think within about the last year, they were able to generalize it to much more general Hamiltonians. So this sort of universal behavior of non-adiabatic transitions associated with single avoided crossings is in much better shape, but only very recently. And it's very hard work. Let's see, then I've got a comment here. There are other generalizations. I've mentioned before that you can get results without any gap at all, but you don't get powers of epsilon. You can't really say what the radius for the error. And there are a lot of other hypotheses that have to go in. Another possibility that I looked at, I guess about, well, maybe it's 20 years ago now, was to allow crossings. And you still have an adiabatic theorem there. For generic crossings, at the crossing, you pick up a new piece, which is order epsilon to the 1/2. Yeah?
Just in point 6, you're talking about a generic subspace? And then a gap to all the other
states? No. Okay. There are results which have no gap whatsoever, and you look at a spectral projection and ask sort of how much do you leave the spectral subspace. Right. So that one, but again, you don't get any nice estimate as to what the error looks like. You just know that the leading term is the sort of adiabatic piece. But the error is smaller, but you don't know how much smaller.
And it can be anything?
Yeah, I believe it can be sort of anything. Alexander's the expert about this. I believe it can be more or less anything.
It depends, of course, on the model. It's usually, right. When you introduce special models, there will be additional parameter. So if you play with this parameter, you can look up some examples where you can, the adiabatic behavior is correct, but the error can be arbitrarily large.
Can it be as good as with it?
It can be, depends on the circumstances.
Yeah. Let's see, so if two eigenvalues cross linearly, the extra piece which pops up as you go through the crossing is order epsilon to the 1/2. If if the two levels are coming together with a quadratic time dependence, it's, as I recall, epsilon to the 1/3. And you can expand this to any order you like, but you start picking up absolutely weird things after a while. You start picking up powers of epsilon times powers of log epsilon. So it's a rather strange business. And let's see, another few comments, again, because I'm not in the quantum computing business, but a few comments that I thought might be useful. There's an explicitly solvable model, which in some sense is trivial. It doesn't have any of the exponentially small pieces, which is just to take the Hamiltonian to the orthogonal projection onto the vector cosine sine in two dimensions. And this is explicitly that projector. And then write the solution in terms of the basis of cosine sine and minus sine cosine. And then write everything in terms of that basis. And you end up studying a problem which is time independent. You can explicitly solve that. And then just put the rotation back in to get into the original. And if you do that in some of the counterexamples, as you use this Hamiltonian as the starting point, you will immediately see that their eigenvectors are functions of t over epsilon for this explicit model. So this is a worthwhile example to keep in mind. It's not really a generic example because the eigenvectors are rotating with constant speed. So that makes it very special. The other comment is, if you give me a two-component system where there's a non-trivial gap, I can just make a change of the time variable by replacing t by this integral, and I end up with a system where the gap is constant. So the sort of variations of the gap can be...
gap is not constant, it can be huge.
Well, but I mean, as a function of t, you can make it constant. Yeah. Well, but it's actually constant in this new variable. You've essentially divided the Hamiltonian for this. Well, no, for any of them, these models, because you've essentially divided the Hamiltonian by the energy difference.
But
so,
for example, if at some point the gap is not of the size g, but much greater, then
when you divide by. But then I'm dividing by something. See, I'm dividing by the gap essentially in order to make the. Yeah, okay. Right, so anyway, so you can trade off bad behavior of the gap with bad behavior of the eigenvector. That's my point. You really have to keep track of two things. It's not just the gap that's mattering here, but also the behavior of the eigenvector. Both things are crucially important. And, I sort of mentioned this is conservation of difficulty. You've just taken the difficult part of the problem and stuck it somewhere else. So you haven't really done anything. But the point is you also have to be paying attention to the eigenvectors, not just the gap. So.
Can I ask a question? Yeah. On your point 7 there, that when you allow a limited number of crossings, are you defining the eigenvector in terms of ordering or in terms of smoothing?
In this case, you define it in terms of smoothness as you go through.
So it's no longer the ground state.
So if, for example, it's no longer the ground state. Yeah, if you go through a level crossing, the system follows the smooth eigenvalue rather than going, say, from the top to the top or the bottom to the bottom. Right, so if you have a linear crossing, it changes. Yeah. And let's see, I thought, just to finish here, I'm about out of time, but I would put up a few pictures associated with these ideas of Michael Berry, again, because I think it might be of some use to you. These pictures are in a paper of Berry and Lim, which is just a numerical implementation of Michael Berry's ideas.
I want you to put up the paper.
Put up the paper? You think that'll look better? That look better?
No.
No. Oh, okay. They're the same. So that's just your, so. Let's see. The there's a change in the vertical scale on all of these graphs. They're all looking at the same problems, and they've looked at two different Hamiltonians. They're wanting to show the universal behavior going on here. So in these bottom graphs, you're trying to get a transition which is of this size. Yeah, but in this first graph, it's very tiny, because they've changed scales on it.
What is plotted?
I'm going to explain that next. What is plotted is the absolute value of the projection into the orthogonal direction for a couple of 2x2 examples. I could write out the Hamiltonians here in a second. So as a function, this has an avoided crossing at time 0. So there's a very small gap at time 0, and then it gets big again. So all the action is happening around time 0. And here, they've just used the eigenvectors. So they've taken the solution and then taken the projection orthogonal to the state you're really interested in, and then plotted the magnitude of that. So you see, as you get near the avoided crossing, there's a big amplitude compared to what you're really trying to see, which is how much transition you're making. Then in the next case, what they've done is the expansion that I used, but keeping the first order terms. And then they projected perpendicular to that. And here's the here's what they get. And now they've changed the scale. What had been very tiny here is now this jump. Then they've gone to second order, projected into the perpendicular direction. And that's this graph. And then the next order, and the next order. And when they've taken the optimal number of terms, they're in this picture. That's what the optimal truncation will do for you. And then if you keep going and take too many terms, life gets worse again. So that was part of the point. So this is another term and another term. And let me just put them. They've got a couple more after that. So you see things are getting worse as you keep on going. So the optimal truncation really is optimal. It produces this sort of time development for the piece in the orthogonal direction. And it's exponentially small, and it looks like an error function, which is making this transition for this class of models. Let's see, the particular models that they've used here, if I can find the chalk again. The first one is the standard Landau-Zener model. So they've taken T11 minus T, or something equivalent to that. There are some other ways of writing it. The sort of objection to this is that the eigenvalues are getting big. They're not approaching constants. So then in the dotted lines, as I recall, they put a hyperbolic tangent of T1, some small number here, not a 1. Delta and minus hyperbolic tangent of T. So those are the two models they looked at and then plotted things in these graphs. So, and then the claim of Michael Berry is whenever sort of one pole in the complex plane is controlling everything, you get exactly this kind of behavior. And again, Bates and Teufel have proved that under additional hypotheses. So I think that's everything that I plan to say. I hope this addresses some of the issues which are of interest to you. Since I'm in a different business, I'm not quite sure. But hopefully this has been useful for you. So thank you very much for your time and attention.
Are there any, there were a few questions during the talk. Are there any additional questions? Yes?
More on the what you call conservation of difficulty. Is there a way to really trade everything in the derivative of the eigenvector into the gap so that we can just really look at the gap?
Yeah, I think you can do that. You can probably more or less take force the time to force yourself into a situation where the, well, I'm not sure. If it sort of rotates and then rotates back, I'm not sure. I see Alexander shaking his head yes.
I think there's a simple representation of the
I could write the board. Yeah, I have never thought about doing that. I've usually thought about going the other direction.
Yeah, phi dot, the magnitude of phi dot is bounded by the magnitude of h dot divided by the gap.
Yeah, that's
right. That's a upper bound. What I mean is like even the lower bound is bounded.
Well, we can't lower bound. I mean, we're interested in the upper bound here because we're interested.
Well, maybe people can discuss this more. Is there another question? Yes,
you mentioned these counter examples that you put forth recently. Are they based on not taking the time dependence on the eigenvector seriously?
That's the ones that I've looked at, that's been the problem. But the eigenvalues have depended properly, but the eigenvectors have not.
I really think we should be very careful. I mean, the Sanders counter example is just a mistake. It's not a counter example. I mean, it's just a error. You know, it has to be just an interchange of limit and an integral, and they get the wrong answer.
But if you look at the Hamiltonian they write down, it's not slowly depending on time.
Yeah, I mean, calling it a counter example, I think, is really dignifying a mistake.
There are some comments besides the MS1.
That's the one that I looked at carefully.
Yeah, I mean, your example, of the constant time, you know, I worked that out also the other day. It's absolutely dead on. It just shows that it's a mistake.
Right.
And it's not a counterexample, it's an error.
Yeah, well, a counterexample to a real theorem has to be an error.
I think that the integration argument is an error, but what about the two-level system that they present?
The two-level system that they present is not slowly varying.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yes.
That's the problem.
Anyway.
Okay, so if there are no other questions, then let's thank George again.